Is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
You're tuned to AM 580. The National Weather Service in Romeoville has issued a flood warning for Livingston County in north central Illinois until 7 p.m. this evening. At 12:54 this afternoon, flooding continued across portions of Livingston County from heavy rains overnight and this morning. This flood warning replaces the flash flood warning in effect for Livingston County. Excessive runoff from heavy rainfall of between 3 to 5 inches continued over portions of Livingston County. Additional thunderstorms are likely this evening and overnight that may produce heavy rain and result in renewed flooding. Flood warning for Livingston County in north central Illinois until 7 o'clock this evening. Meanwhile, for the WILL severe weather coverage area, a flood watch continues for Ford and Iroquois counties through tomorrow morning, and a flash flood watch is in effect for Champaign, DeWitt, McLean, Piatt, and Vermilion counties through Thursday morning. Stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest on the weather. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Trevor Norton is a marine biologist. His fascination with the sea began as a boy growing up on St. Mary's Island, Northumberland, on the northeast coast of England. He dreamed, he says, of oceans bluer than his. Here's how he expresses his awakening in the preface to his book, Underwater to Get Out of the Rain. I grew up beside a sullen sea rimmed with coal dust, and that was where I first felt the tug of the tide. But the whisper in the shells was of bluer oceans beyond the horizon, salt-scented and transparent, alive with strange creatures. That is the preface to Trevor Norton's book, Underwater to Get Out of the Rain. Trevor Norton is our guest in this portion of the program. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Trevor Norton is professor of marine biology at the University of Liverpool and director of the Port Erin Marine Laboratory on the Isle of Man. Underwater to Get Out of the Rain is part memoir, part natural history. It is a lovely book and has won a great deal of critical praise. The book, illustrated by Wynne Norton, was first published in May of 2006. It's now out in a paperback edition from DeCapo Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Trevor Norton, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure, Celeste.
So what's this evening like there on the Isle of Man where you
Absolutely
are?
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. Lucky
gorgeous
you.
Gorgeous day, gorgeous evening.
Lucky you. Lucky you.
I know.
When you were a boy, your parents were called to your school by the headmaster. He called you the worst boy in the school. How bad were you? What had you done to get into trouble?
Well, I don't remember doing anything really bad. I just took the pride in being the very, very worst. That's not an easy title to gain. I just guess I always hated school, I must confess. And I did everything to get out of doing things. And my school reports tell the story. It says, by the time he learns to speak French, he'd be too old to cross the channel. And we used to, it was a school where you were divided, and you didn't go to the top school. You went to the other school. It was more practical. You know, it'd teach you practical things. So the lads did woodwork and metalwork, and I came bottom of the class in that. And the report said, much improved work this term. So I wasn't the star pupil. And then I saw some TV programs with a chap called Hans Haas, who was a very handsome Austrian. And he had this gorgeous wife called Lottie. just reminiscing. And I was determined that was it. He was a diver, and he went diving to adventure. And I decided I was going to grow up to be a handsome Austrian and do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Lucky it's radio. You can't see the extent of your sales.
I'm sure you're a handsome man, because you won the heart of Win Price.
That's right, Win Price, yes.
Yes, yes.
And in fact, I've just retired now. I'm no longer a prof. I'm an emeritus prof, one without merit.
Oh, okay.
And I, when I retired, my wife said, well, perhaps I should take a bigger share in the chores. Perhaps I could do the cleaning, cooking, washing, ironing, shopping, decorating, and gardening, and see she'd take care of the remote for the TV. So tempting though that was, I tried to look busy by writing books. And as you said in the introduction, my wife illustrates them with beautiful drawings.
Yeah, the drawings are lovely. The illustrations are beautiful. And she was she caught your eye.
I'm not quite sure that's the way it was. I mean, I do remember when we were going to get engaged, she told her mother about our engagement, and the mother just said, oh. And, well, at least he makes you laugh, she said.
Mm.
But I don't think it was a very popular choice. But it was just one of those things. We actually shared a lab. We were both doing our PhDs together. And
right.
It was in the 60s, and, you know, they had miniskirts and so on. And I'd like to say it was her brains that attracted me, but it was so much to attract your attention. It was difficult to remember.
Yeah. Well, you got a combination there.
I did. Yeah. I did indeed, yes.
Very fortunate. So this television show inspired you to get into the water.
Absolutely.
So what were your first efforts? At getting wet.
Well, I didn't have a diving mask or anything like that. I took it first, my very first dive. I just went in. I think I had some swimming goggles and some bathing trunks, and I tied a toasting fork onto a bamboo pole, and that was it. That was my full equipment. But I was so lucky. The very first dive, I was holding my breath, of course, and the very first time I went under, I think, suddenly this dark javelin pierced the water. In a cone of bubbles, it was a big black bird, a cormorant, and it was fishing, and it was the most spectacular thing I'd ever seen. And I knew from that moment I was going to spend a lot more time underwater.
Yeah. What other kinds of things did you see there in the waters of Whitley Bay?
Oh, it's quite rich, really. This is the North Sea, which, as I said, is a sullen sea. But there's lots of kelp and lots of other colored seaweeds. There's all the sort of things you'd see if you went diving off the east coast of the United States in abundance. And since in those days there weren't any divers, nothing was shy or afraid of divers, and there was no one else seeing it. I mean, that was 50-odd years ago. And I really did feel everywhere I went underwater, even in Britain, I'd be the very first person to see that particular underwater landscape.
Hmm. That snorkeling that you did there as a boy, that was transformative.
Yep.
Did you know then, when you had that encounter with the cormorant, that you were going to spend your life as a student of the sea?
Yeah, it changed my... I suddenly started passing exams, which was a complete unknown, a surprise to everyone. And within 2 years, I'd transferred to a better school, and within 2 more years, I'd gone to university.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone could have predicted that.
Yeah.
I went to a school reunion only a couple of weeks ago. Hadn't seen the people there for 50-odd years. And one of the masters was there, and he was obviously aghast that I'd done so well.
Yeah. This is something that parents would be good to take note of. You were too busy to be bad.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think once you've found something, I mean, mm-hmm. as I say, I did dislike school, because there was nothing there that seemed to interest me. And suddenly when I had something to aim for, something I wanted to be, then school became much more interesting and important. And some of my teachers were really very good and helped me quite a lot.
Yeah. At that point, were you beginning then to pick up books of natural history?
Oh, yeah. I'd always been a reader, actually. There were no books in my house as a kid, except mine. And I had a large collection of books. By the time I was about 18, I had an enormous collection of books. I was very, very ill a few years ago, and I just, for something to do, I estimated how many hardback novels I had. And I realized that if I was going to read two a week, I'd have to live to be 168 to finish them all.
Mm. What were your favorite books as a child?
Oh, I think various things. But one thing, I liked sort of humorous books, I must confess. There was a Canadian humorist called Stephen Leacock, who was also an academic, and I thought his books were wonderful. They were something from the 30s and 40s, much before my time, but they were very funny. But I loved adventure books. Do you remember the Kon-Tiki expedition where Thor Heyerdahl went across the Pacific in a balsa wood raft?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a fantastic book. Mm-hmm. It was a book that was turned down by about 40 publishers, I seem to remember, but then became a bestseller. Wonderful books. I love adventure books. People doing something out of the ordinary and meeting extraordinary people or strange phenomena.
Yeah. Well, now, at home, when Wynne says the chores are done, what are you reading?
I'm writing a new book, and that's what I find now. I'm reading a lot, but I'm always reading for the next book now. So I've been reading lots of books on medical history and so on, because I'm writing a book that's about people who experiment on themselves. You know, people who've taken drugs or drunk down cholera to see if you can catch it that way and knock themselves out by just sniffing everything they can find to see if they can find an anesthetic. Extraordinary people and wonderful stories.
Yeah.
But really, they're all pretty well crazy.
Yeah. This, thinking of something that, you know, when people try things and they're not sure if they're going to work or not. You tell a story in Underwater to Get Out of the Rain of being in the Canary Islands and going fishing there quite a bit. And one of the ways that they fish there or did was with the spear or with lowering a hook, or, this is really fascinating, this is a very old method there, they would use a substance from a cactus plant.
Yep.
How do people figure out these kinds of things?
I know. I suppose you could do that by accident. You could, you could drop. Someone could have swallowed themselves and dropped dead. And they thought, oh, I wonder if it works with Uncle George. Perhaps it'll work with a fish. these are really big. They're not actually cacti, because there aren't any cacti in the old world. But you'd never know. I mean, if you saw these things, even Arizonans would say, "Wow, that's a wonderful cactus. They're huge cacti-looking things." But they've got a very rich white sap, and it's very, very poisonous. I mean, some of the common garden plants are in the same group, the euphorbias, and I suppose they just tried it once and it worked.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is not that this stuff might poison fish and, well, you know, bring them to the surface. It's the fact that you wouldn't be poisoned by eating the fish.
Right.
That's also the second part of the experiment that you have to try.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of fish did you catch there in the Canary Islands?
The Canary Islands is kind of open ocean water, and it's quite far south. So what you get is not many of the northern fish that we would get in Britain, like the cod and that sort of thing, but you get quite a lot of the sort of semi-warm water fish. Lots of things you'd see in the Mediterranean you'd see there, but nothing unusual apart from a whole variety, wonderful variety of different sorts of eels, very, very brightly colored, I remember. But lots of wrath and various things like that.
Yeah. And the one of the scenes that I found beautiful there that you paint for readers is fishing for squid with your friend Emilio.
Yep.
Yeah. What a lovely time that was.
It was a very nice time, because it was quite a long trip. I was there for the whole summer. And this local lad, Emilio, I'd actually met on the boat going out, and we became good friends for the period. And he stayed with his family, and they had a little boat. And the boat really was very little indeed. It was like some hollowed-out wooden banana. And we'd go way, way out of sight of land. And this was at night for jigging for squid. And we just put down a little sort of bright thing on a hook, or a whole series of hooks, and then just jog it, but in quite deep water. It would let out a heck of a lot of line.
Mm.
But it was just being on the ocean. You know, you normally, if you're on a boat, the boat's moving at some rate. And often there's a motor that's very noisy and smelly and so on. Here we were just wallowing in this big Atlantic swell, these great hills of water, and you'd rise up and then you'd slide down. And it was all done without any noise. And it was really, when you're out there in the moonlight, wondering whether you'll ever see land again, it really was very beautiful, but a bit nerve-wracking. But the silence of the ocean is quite surprising out there. You'd think it'd be very noisy, and of course, if the wind blows, it is. But it was the silence and the stars and these wonderful hills of water.
And the squid.
And the squid, yeah. I felt a bit sorry for the squid, because when they come up, they tend to flash. I mean, they've got these wonderful ways of flashing colors, and they have a sort of neon lighting almost, because they can contract and expand different areas of the body to reveal different colors. And even they've got silver plates and gold plates, so they can not only have colors, but also these metallic ripples. And this, I'm sure these were distress ripples that we were seeing. But everything was eaten. I mean, we only caught what the family could eat, and then we'd go back.
Was the distress over you?
Oh, no, it was distress of being hauled out of the water, I think.
Oh, okay. You know, so
they wouldn't like that.
Yeah, okay. So,
and I suppose they knew that wasn't ideal, especially when they'd come up quite a long way from the depths. They don't come to any harm, not like most fish. If you bring most fish up quickly from the depths, then they explode because they've got a sort of gas bladder inside to keep them at a particular buoyancy level. And that expands like a balloon when they come up, but not in things like squid.
Yeah. Did you ever suffer, have you ever suffered from seasickness?
No. I once did. Coming when I was a student, I came over to the Isle of Man. I was on a field course, you know. And I remember reading a book while the ferry was wallowing through the waves. And I felt a bit ill then, but now I'm very lucky I haven't been seasick. And I can't imagine many things worse. It looks terrible.
Yeah.
It doesn't look good.
Yeah. Well, I'm a Midwesterner, so I don't get to spend much time on the water, but I do love it. And I've been fortunate not to be seasick, even in some pretty rough water. But I remember as a kid, I spent a day out on a boat, you know, on a river, and I came home and I lay down on the bed and the bed felt like it was moving.
Oh, yes. That happens a lot. That happened to me, too.
Yeah. And I said to my mother, "What is this?" And she said, "It's seasickness."
I said,
it feels good. I enjoyed it. I felt like I was back on the river.
Yeah. I think you're always just adjusting your position when you're rocking on a boat. And perhaps when you go to bed, you're still doing it to a certain extent. I don't know. But it's certainly a real feeling. I felt it.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Trevor Norton. He's a marine biologist, and he is the author of, among other books, Underwater to Get Out of the Rain, A Love Affair with the Sea. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments for our guest, Trevor Norton. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us about some of the other amazing places that your travels have taken you over the years.
Oh, I think one of the most memorable probably was the South Yemen, as it was called then. Americans will know about Yemen because that's where one of their warships was attacked by terrorists, if you remember, in Aden Harbor. I went there about 15 years ago, I guess, and I should have been warned when I got there. There was the waiting room in the airport was sprayed with bullet holes, and that was obviously a bad sign. Before I left the airport, soldiers had actually taken my camera, taken the film out, and stamped on it, even though I hadn't taken any photographs. And indeed, I had a license from the government to take them, but it was a very frightening place. You could buy Kalashnikovs in the market for about $25, and they were kidnapped daily. Mm. And I was unlucky enough to be there at the anniversary of the British withdrawal from Aden, which is the capital of the South Yemen. And the only thing that was on TV were documentaries about the British troops firing over the heads of the crowds or beating people over the head with clubs. So I was relieved to get to the shore. The trouble was that when you went wading and diving, you couldn't see anything at all because the water was completely opaque with suspended mud, I guess. And the whole place was alive with sea snakes.
Oh.
I mean, they're very common here, especially when they're mating. They come inshore. And someone reported a mass of these writhing sea snakes, which was 10 feet wide and 60 miles long. And these things are about 10 times more poisonous than a cobra. Happy days. So I've spent a lot of time in the Pacific coast of North America, too. I've been in Washington State. There's the University of Washington have a lovely marine lab in the San Juan Islands, and I've spent several summers there teaching graduate students and researching. In fact, my son was conceived in Friday Harbor in the States, and I was a Fulbright-Hays scholar in the States, and I had an 18-month sabbatical at Santa Barbara as well. So I spent a lot of time there. In fact, I was once buzzed by Randy Seals in the darkness of a Californian cave in the Channel Islands. Oh, it's no laughing matter. It's quite they're quite intimidating when they think you're a rival male, and it was absolutely dark. That wasn't nice.
Oh.
I have a colleague here, though, in the Isle of Man, female colleague, and she was seduced by a dolphin. He was a tame dolphin called Donald, who just hung around, and when you were doing research, he'd come and put his head on your shoulder, see what you were doing. But one day, he pinned her to the rock, and that was it. He was going to make love, you know. Aristotle once said that mating in the dolphin didn't take very long, but then, of course, he'd never participated.
Easy for him to say.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I remember once in the Puget Sound off Seattle, coming across a giant octopus, which are not supposed to be uncommon there, and they get really very big. I think this one was quite small. It was only about, I guess, 6 feet across. But they're really quite impressive creatures. As I approached him, he pumped out two horns from the top of his head. You know,
wow.
and they have these incredibly human eyes. Their eyes are almost identical to ours, and they follow you around and looking at what you're doing. And when they've got a great big beak like a parrot, huge beak like a parrot, and they've got these eight snaky suckered arms, you couldn't come up with a better alien for one of these sci-fi films, could you?
No.
I mean, if this thing stalked the night in Seattle on land, I don't think anyone would go out.
Yeah.
I mean, really quite extraordinary creatures. In fact, when you go underwater, when you go diving, you've kind of changed planets. And none of the animals you see are anything like anything on land. They're all quite extraordinarily different.
Yeah. And that's why you say, if given the choice of shooting off into space or going below, you'd go below.
I think that's right. Well, I mean, we hardly know anything about the ocean. It's the least explored part of the planet. We know more about the face of the moon, I suspect. You know, in the middle of all the oceans, like the Atlantic and the Pacific and all the others, there's an ocean ridge, and it's continuous. Thousands and thousands of huge mountains, 44,000 miles of them. It's a quarter of the Earth's surface, and we didn't know it even existed until the 1950s. All the samples we've taken from the deep ocean could all go into one aircraft hangar. That's how little we know about it.
Hmm.
You know, and if I could send you down, Celeste, in a submersible, and send you just one mile down to the ocean, and I said to you, just pick up some animal, any animal you like, and bring it back. If you did that, the chances are 50-50 that animal would be a new species to science that we'd never, ever seen before.
Hmm.
And, you know, even big creatures, the ocean's so large, even huge creatures can go undetected. The giant squid can get up to about 15 meters long. And although we know they exist because they're occasionally washed up, we've only seen one underwater once. That's all.
Hmm.
And in 1976, the University, the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in San Diego, found a huge basking shark, a new species. 12 meters long, 3/4 ton, and it had never been seen before. So there's plenty of things to find in this almost completely unexplored place.
Yeah. Well, yesterday we talked with a fellow who is a biologist, historian, writer, and he is the author of A History of Whaling in America.
Yeah.
And we talked about one of the things that he writes a little bit about in the book is the life of the sperm whale. And now here's a creature that we have known about for a long, long time. And Dolan calls it the whale's whale. But there are so many questions about this,
yep,
this species. And, you know, and I don't know where I'm going here with this example.
I think you'd think if it's big and we've been hunting,
yeah,
for a century or more, you'd know a lot about it. But all that was known about it was a bit of folklore from the whalers about where it was likely to turn up and how to catch it. And in the good old days, of course, when they used to go out in small boats to catch these big whales, there was at least as good a chance the whale would get the whaler as the other way around. It's not quite like that now. But it's just because it's big, and even if it's big and common, it doesn't mean it's easy to study. Big,
mm-hmm,
animals are quite difficult to study. You know, you can tag them if you can get a tag on, but only a relatively small number get tagged, so you can only trace the movements of them, of very few of them. And you can't see what they're doing. You only know what depth they've gone to and where they are. So we know very little about their private life, because most of it takes place not on the surface, but way, way,
way
down.
Way below.
Well, these things are fantastic divers. I mean, they really are incredible divers.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned earlier the squid, giant squid. You know, what happens when a sperm whale and a giant squid mix it up?
Well, we know they do, because it wasn't uncommon to find squid sucker marks on large whales. So obviously there had been some tussles, because and the sucker marks really do make a sort of mark. They make a scar almost. But I suspect my money would be on the whale, if it's a toothed whale of some sort. I think that would be the one that would likely win, and probably the... The squid was hanging on for dear life, probably.
You know, given all that we don't know, all the mysteries that are out there, and all the treasures that have yet to be, and I don't mean treasure as taking things and cashing in, but I mean the treasure of knowledge. Are young people clamoring to get into marine biology and other fields within, you know?
Well, I think that... It's never been difficult for schools of marine biology, certainly in Britain, I suspect the same is true in the United States, to get students wanting to do marine biology. Some now are perhaps being, you know, a little more sanguine and going for things that are better paid. But certainly we've had no problem getting students in my experience during my sort of teaching lifetime. I think partially because... usually in films, either the hero or more likely the villain who's about to control the entire world is a marine biologist. I think half the villains in James Bond books seem to be marine biologists. And these guys seem to do pretty well until the last reel. So I think that that's one of the attractions.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Marine biologist. Scary guy. Trevor Norton is our guest in this portion of the program. He is the author of the book, Underwater to Get Out of the Rain, A Love Affair with the Sea. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. We'd like for you to join the conversation if you have a question or a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned folklore a moment ago.
Mm.
And, you know, once upon a time, the sea and the shore were pretty scary places, especially if you had to make your living there. Even before people really turned to the sea to make a living, I suppose, it was a frightening place. But today, we turn to the sea and kind of hope for a monster to emerge. And,
oh yeah.
And you write a little bit about this, and there's a huge carcass that washed ashore. I think you were a young man or a boy, and it turned out not to be anything too exciting in the long run. But the biologists came along and identified it, and everyone was disappointed except probably the biologists. They wanted a sea monster.
Yeah.
So what's that about?
Well, I guess we are we're getting more accustomed to people wanting to believe things that are unlikely. You know what I mean? We now prefer conspiracy theories to what seems like a much more sensible, likely explanation. We prefer the complicated story. And I think we would like to have not just nice monsters. We don't mind having horrendous monsters, you know, in the sea. And the idea of finding one, wouldn't that be great?
Mm-hmm.
But yes, certainly, it was when I was a boy, and the papers were full of disappointment, and people said, oh, what a pity, I thought it was going to be a sea monster. Because I guess you can boast, if you're not a very important place, you can say, ah, this is where the great sea monster washed ashore, you know. And there was, you know, people believe, I don't know about, I lived in Scotland for many, many years, but I didn't see the Loch Ness monster.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's been so many people who believe in that and so many supposed sightings and so on. It seems very unlikely to me. But who knows? I mean, it's nice to believe. I kind of believe in mermaids, don't you, you know?
Yeah.
These beautiful, dangerous women. Actually, when Columbus went across to the Americas, he saw several mermaids, and he said they weren't anywhere near as beautiful as they were cracked up to be. And certainly we haven't seen them anywhere near as much since the invention of the camera. Yeah. Although I was in the Philippines in 1994, and the headline in the paper was, Two Youths Drowned by Mermaid.
Yeah.
Now, I think, if there's no such thing as mermaids, how come every kid at school can draw one?
Yeah.
Now, exactly what they look like. And see, the marine biologists' rather mundane explanation is these are not beautiful women they saw. These are dugongs. Now, you know what a dugong looks like. It's like imagine a seagoing sofa. And it's got industrial strength halitosis. Now, what I wonder is, how long do you have to be at sea to think that's a beautiful woman? Mm. I mean, that must be a long voyage, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And don't you love the stories of the Selkies, you know, in the Celtic world, in Ireland and Scotland? There are lots of stories of seals which were always considered to be half-human. And only this week, it was very misty, and I was out walking with my wife and I, and we could hear through the mist the seals moaning, these plaintive cries.
Mm-hmm.
And you would swear it was people. You know, and the story of the Selkies is usually it comes ashore, and the seal sheds its skin, and it's a beautiful woman beneath. But they're always sad tales of loss and longing. They never end well. And I think that they're actually beautiful. I mix the stories in my book because I kind of feel myths and legends reveal as much about a place and about the people as do the facts of their existence.
Yeah.
I think that legends and myths are actually quite important things.
Yeah. Well, what child hasn't been enchanted or wondered what is within the siren song?
Mm.
You know?
Well, they certainly do, and manatees and things do make, they're actually in a group of animals called the Sirenae. They are actually in the Sirenaceae, so they are renowned for their calls. But even so, these mermaids used to, you know, be combing their long blonde hair. Now, this is girls that spent all their time in the sea before wash and go. I can't see how they get a comb through their hair.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I think the mariners exaggerated.
Yeah. Well, you know, on those voyages, they could be tedious.
Yep.
And there's plenty of time to sit back and tell tales.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And great tales sometimes. My previous book was about time in Ireland, and a lot of the stories I got from the local people were just wonderful. They remembered every detail of things, and the Irish are wonderful. Storytellers. And in fact, I guess we gave them some stories to tell because one of the people that was one of my mentors was a chap called Jack Kitching. When I was a graduate student, I was so busy playing soccer and chasing girls that it was difficult to actually fit in any actual research. And my supervisor said to me one day, Norton, I'm sending you too. And it was Ireland. I thought it was going to be Alcatraz. But it was Ireland to go and work with this chap called Professor Kitching, Jack Kitching, and he was wonderful. He was a pioneer of diving. In 1931, he walked into a dairy and said to the man behind the counter, I'm thinking of exploring underwater world. I'm going to need some diving equipment. And the dairyman said, well, yes, sir, that'll be advisable, wondering what on earth it had to do with cows. And then Jack Kitching said, have you got a large milk can, one that would go over my head? He bought the can, put a window in the front, attached it to a hose pipe and an automobile car tire pump, and that was his entire diving equipment. Oh, except he put a little microphone in. And the idea was he'd go underwater with this on his head, and he would dictate everything he saw to a secretary. But the only words he ever said was, "More air! More air!" But he was a wonderful fellow, absolutely wonderful, as legendary as any selkie or mermaid.
Yeah.
I remember once I was retrieving some equipment in Ireland from the bottom of the sea, and he was bobbing around in a little boat on the surface waiting for me, and a local came by. And the local said, "Is it fishing you are?" And Jack said, "Oh, no, not fishing. We're measuring the ambient irradiance in the laminaria forest in the sublittoral zone." "Oh," he says, "that's what I was thinking it was." But he didn't go. He hung around to see what was really going on.
Yeah.
And then I came to the surface, and all that Jack said to me, of course, I knew nothing of this, and Jack said in a loud voice, "Is the warhead intact, Carruthers?" And all I could hear was tapaka, 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 as this local shot to the shore. He was rowing. And the next day, everyone knew that a misguided missile had gone to the sea off Southern Ireland and the whole place was radioactive. So Jack Kitchen was quite a character.
Oh.
I mean, I can tell you hundreds of stories and you wouldn't believe any of them, but they would all be true.
Yeah. Back to stories and legends and folklore. How and when did the legend of Nessie, the Loch Ness monster, begin?
I think there are vague stories from way, way back, I mean, a couple of hundred years back or more. But it only really started taking off again, I think, in the 1920s and 30s, when people started taking photographs of things which might have been a monster. You know what I mean? They were really quite difficult to know what they were. Some of them looked as though they'd been taken before the invention of the camera, but certainly none were very clear. But they got into the newspapers, and people said another sighting of Nessie, and that made people going up to Loch Ness. Loch Ness is a huge, huge lake. It's an enormous lake. So you could actually have monsters hiding in it. It wouldn't be too difficult. But I don't think there are. I think it's rather a tall story.
Yeah.
But well, it certainly took off in the 1930s when there were lots more sightings, supposedly.
Yeah. Well, we're back to that idea of who doesn't like a great story.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there have been lots of money that's been spent trying to search for monsters in all parts of the world, or fictitious animals. And, of course, some of the fictitious animals turned out to be factual animals. They were real.
Yeah. Well, there are plenty of scary things in the sea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, even little things are scary, really. You know, if you think of something like, I don't know, a starfish, it doesn't look much like being kind of carved out of wood to us, but once it embraces a clam, the clam's doomed. There's no way it's going to win a tug of war with a starfish. And, you know, a sea anemone looks like an animal trying to be a flower, but each one of those little tentacles is lined with hypodermics packed with poison.
Mm.
It's a deadly creature. And crabs are assassins in pie crust. So all these animals that we think, oh, a bit quaint, these are actually very dangerous creatures if you're small. Luckily, we're big. If we were small, our first trip to the seaside might well be our last.
Yeah.
So it depends on your scale, what's a monster. I mean, a crab's a pretty monstrous thing,
yeah,
especially if you're very tiny.
Well, even if you're only at risk of having your toe caught, still pretty.
A decent-sized crab could easily break a snap your finger.
Yeah,
I mean, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
They're quite nice. You keep the clippers in front of you when you're picking them up. But they are extraordinary things. I mean, they do look like some sort of ancient knight in armor, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they're fascinating. I mean, the Olympic group. I think the starfish are too, and all their relatives.
Yeah, and the lobster is a very interesting creature.
Yeah. Well, did you know you could put a lobster, just tilt a lobster on its head, so it's doing a handstand with its head and its hand and its claws, and if you just stroke it, it'll stay there. It just leave it alone. It just sort of goes into a trance and it'll stay there until you take it down.
Huh.
Don't know why you'd want to do it, but I have seen it done. And it does work. There must be some biological purpose for it. I'm sure perhaps it's something that the female does to the male, or try and put him to sleep so that she can wander off.
Hmm. Interesting. And all the things that these animals have developed in order to protect themselves. Very, very fascinating. Tell us about the sea cucumber.
Well, I mean, it is a dangerous place, and you've got to have some sort of protection. But certainly sea cucumbers, quite often what they do, and most sea cucumbers do this. These are relatives, by the way, of sea urchins and starfish, but they look like a long sausage. And if they're attacked, what they often do is they shed the whole of their gut. The whole of their gut just is popped out and then left behind, and they scuttle off. And the idea, I guess, is that the predator says, oh, here's something for tea, and they eat the guts, start munching into that, and they don't notice that the actual animal is drifting away, as it were.
Yeah.
But it takes some months for the gut to regenerate, and during that period, the cucumber can't eat. So there's a price to pay for escaping with your life, as it were.
Yeah. Crash diet.
It sure is.
And sea cucumbers, there are more sea cucumbers in the sea than there are people.
Yeah, it's astonishing. I mean, for most people, I mean, they are fairly common in various parts of the world. You can see them if you go diving. But one would never think they were that abundant. But if you go deep enough, we're talking about going several miles down, there is the kingdom of the cucumbers. And they are the dominant animal. And these quite large animals, like a small rabbit, some of them, are just go around in huge herds, groveling in the mud, because they eat the mud. They just go down, snuffling in the mud the whole time. But there are zillions of them. They are just huge numbers.
Mm.
It's just... The deep ocean isn't anywhere near as monotonous in species as we thought it was. There's far more variety there than we thought. But some animals are there in colossal numbers, and the sea cucumber is one of them.
Oh. What can you tell us about, what are your thoughts about where we are today in terms of the health of the oceans?
Well, if you want to know whether I'm an optimist or a pessimist, yeah. I guess I'd say both. I'm optimistic in the sense that we have, to a very large extent, made inroads in tackling pollution. You know, when I was a student and I was going to go from Scotland to Ireland, I got on the boat in the River Clyde near Glasgow, and you couldn't stay on deck because the river smelled so much. And I have a feeling, wasn't there a river? It wasn't in Illinois, was it? That was a fire hazard.
Oh, it was one of the lakes, the Great
Lakes. One of the lakes, was it? You know, I mean, that's how bad it was. Whereas now, in British rivers at least, they've cleaned them up so much with sewage treatment and goodness knows what else. Now you can commonly see things like dolphins and small whales not stranded, but actually frolicking in the middle of cities. And most of our big rivers have salmon going way up them now. Now, and that hasn't been the case for hundreds of years. In the 1840s, the British Parliament had to close down because of the big stink of the river. So things like that have improved enormously, except that there's another side to it. Like most things, it's not simple.
Mm-hmm.
In the estuaries, in big rivers, you usually get lots of mud flats. And these are places where you get hundreds of thousands of wading birds because they grovel in the mud for the creatures that live there, little worms and other things. And these worms and bugs were fed by the sewage that was coming down the river. So they thrived, and so there was plenty of food for the birds. With cleaning up the river, these bugs are actually much less common now in the mud, and so the bird populations are declining because it's too clean. So we have done a lot like that. And the public, I think, are much more aware of the environment than they were even 20 years ago, the importance of forests and clean oceans and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There's much more awareness of that, which has got to be a good thing.
Yeah.
But I am pessimistic that governments have been so slow to take action on global warming. I think that's a sin. And even gone to the extent of toning down reports by government scientists so they don't sound so nerve-wracking. I fear our grandchildren may never forgive us for it.
Mm. Speaking of children and grandchildren, going back to your days as a boy on St. Mary's Island, The natural world was so important to you, and that's something also that we're learning about, is green spaces and open spaces and wild places are really important to our well-being, our mental well-being.
I think that I was very, very ill with two forms of cancer a few years ago, and I found the natural environment was tremendous help. We've got a lovely headland just beyond our house. So we walked to the headland, and we did it just the other night, and you could look down and see basking sharks and so on. And I found it kind of refreshes the soul. You go out in nature, and you do feel so much better. Whatever the problem is, you felt that somehow, although it hadn't been solved, this had somehow made it better. And I think that the things that I remember most, even going diving when I've seen really quite spectacular sights, some of the things I remember most are quite simple things. I remember once just lying on the bottom of the sea, but shallow water, in the dark, looking at the surface with the waves undulating, and I watched the moon go waltzing. It just waltzed around and pirouetted, and then it split into two moons, and they danced with each other for a little while, then they fused again. And I thought, what a fantastic thing, you know, a most beautiful thing. And you could only see it by being there out in nature at that moment, looking in the right direction. Mm. And I think that's good for the soul.
Yeah. Well, keep looking. And thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Oh, it's been my pleasure entirely.
Take care, and the best to your wife and children.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Trevor Norton has been our guest in this portion of the program. Look for his book, Underwater to Get Out of the Rain, A Love Affair with the Sea. The book is now out in a paperback edition from DeCapo Press. It is 1:53 Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. I'm going to turn things over now to Todd Gleason, who has settlement prices for us now from Kansas City and from Chicago.
Thanks much, Celeste. Sure is a lot of fun to watch the Chicago Board of Trade and the Kansas City Board of Trade. If you don't have things invested in it, but if you've got margin calls coming your way, it's a pretty tough week. A lot of down movement in the first couple of days and a little bounce today. We'll find out why this afternoon when we talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. That comes up at 6 after the hour at 2 o'clock. During the closing market report this afternoon, we'll ask him how it was that September wheat managed a 22.25 cent gain in Chicago to settle at 623.5, their top there at 627.5, and the bottom at 599.25. September wheat 623.5 in Chicago for the soft red, 22.25 higher. September in Kansas City at 606 on their settlement, up 20 cents. December futures from Chicago now 645, the high, the low at 15. Settlement price for the soft red and December contract at 642.5, up 25.25, and the March contract up 22.25 at 647. Their high at 647, the low at 623.5. May futures 634, the high, and their settlement price, they were up 24, their low at $6.10, and July contract at 575 on their high, the low at 5.